Hi, we've got a special edition today of the Iran Brooks Show, and I am going to be interviewed by one of our interns here at ARI. We have six interns, I think, that are funded by the Koch Foundation, those evil Koch brothers. Charles Koch, specifically this is from the Charles Koch Foundation, and we have six interns working full-time over the summer at ARI. They do a combination of work and some studying and helping out and learning something about objectivism. And one of the interns has volunteered for the tough assignment of asking me questions. And I have no idea what the questions are. I heard they're really, really tough and deep and philosophical. So I think we're in for a treat. I think this will be a fun show and interesting. So I'm going to let you introduce yourself, Chris. Why don't you tell us where you're from, what you've studied, and what you've been doing at the Iran Institute for the last few almost months, weeks?
Yeah, no, it's been 2 months now. Terrifyingly enough, and my last day is tomorrow, so our ride is just about finished.
Oh wow, we're gonna miss you.
And so I'm from Illinois, so from the heartland. Just graduated from Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Taking a year off before making the unfortunate decision to go into graduate studies in philosophy. So that's where my life is headed. Spending the summer here, and we'll see what goes on from there.
So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing at the Institute while you've been here.
Yeah, so I've been entirely in the content division. So I've done some research for Ankara Gatte. I've done some research for Aaron Smith. I'm doing something right now on Islamophobia and the idea of that word, where it comes from, for Elan Giorno. So they've had me sort of all over the spectrum of topics.
Good, good. All right, so the format's going to be pretty simple. Chris is going to ask me questions. I'm going to do my best to answer them, and then he might have some follow-up, so he might switch to other stuff. But we're going to try to make this a conversation, and we're going to try to delve into some issues, and I think that the show today will be pretty much dedicated to answering Chris's questions. So floor is yours, Chris.
All right. So when I was thinking about what kinds of things to be asking you and what kind of things to be talking about, I was listening to some of your previous episodes. And there was one episode in particular after the RNC where you introduced a topic, you said, but that's enough about politics, let's get away and talk about the culture for a little while. And then you were inundated with about 45 minutes of questions about Donald Trump.
Yep.
So I promise you, no matter what we talk about today, this right here is the last time I will mention the words Donald J.
Yes!
Trump.
Yes, I'm so happy.
So you would introduce this topic of, politics is one thing, politics is important, but how do you actually go about changing the culture? And then you never really got the chance to get to that. So I guess my first question is, just very briefly, can you talk about what you mean when you say changing the culture?
Well, what I mean by changing, so what is the culture? The culture is kind of the sum of all the achievements in a particular geographic place. So you know, what is the culture of America? It's kind of the sum of the achievements that is America, that individuals within America have done. And it's achievements across the entire board, whether it's in music and in art and in business and in science and in technology and in politics. And so it's a combination of all of that. That sum is American culture. It's the culture in which Americans live in. And it's interesting because Ayn Rand always said that in a significant sense, America doesn't have a culture. And it's a real problem, I think, and it always has been a problem, because America has always, at least when it came to the arts, and an art's a very important part of a culture, America's always defaulted to Europe. Europe was the place, and we were always playing catch-up. So we don't have any great American composers. I mean, you can think of Aaron Copland and a few others, but there's no real tradition of, there's no Beethoven or Brahms of America. There are no great painters in the tradition of the French Academy, or there's no Michelangelo of America. So the arts, now there's some literature, and most of that literature, unfortunately, was naturalistic. So it was not romantic, wasn't Ayn Rand kind of romanticism. Of course, Ayn Rand is an American author, so she's part of this culture. So, but America's strong, has a strong sense of science and respect for reason and a strong sense of business, of course. That's where we're really strong. In the more material side of the culture, Americans have always been strong. So what do we mean by changing the culture? I think today, so let's talk about what the culture is like today. I think today the culture has moved to, for example, resent business, resent success. There's more and more talk, again, by the intellectual leaders, by the people who kind of shape things, about everything being a consequence of luck. You're not self-made anymore. Science, people are skeptical about science, whether it's because of religion, stem cell research is banned, at least, what do you call it, fetal stem cells was banned by Bush, and there's always controversy around that, global warming, what is government funding do to that, is that distorting science? So there's a lot of, I think, today skepticism. The whole creationist movement in the United States, which I think has come to prominence in the last few decades and wasn't really that prominent. I think after the Scopy trials, the monkey trials in, I don't know, when was that, the 20s or 30s? I think kind of evolution won, and then suddenly in the last 15, 20 years, creationism is back. So I think there are a lot of very negative trends in American culture. Religion and its institutionalization, it was always there, but it's become much more open, much more institutionalized, much more into politics, much more in education. Skepticism of science, and at the university level, skepticism of reason. So reason doesn't count. It is, you know, there is no truth, so why bother in a sense? You know, consciousness is primary, so we create our own reality. Logic is, there is no such thing really as logic. It depends on who you are and what you are. So the non-objectivity and of knowledge, which is prevalent today at the universities. So reason is under attack, knowledge is under attack, objectivity is under attack. And of course, in morality, America's always had this approach to self-sacrifice and altruism, but that, I think, has become, again, worse and more part of the culture, and it's part of the resentment towards business leaders and part of the resentment of success, and it's luck, and it doesn't matter. Some in the left believe that there's no justice because everything's luck, right? Everything's determined. Now, in addition, I think if you look at, this is where I get into trouble, right? If you look at popular culture has become enamored with what people have called gangster culture, right? With kind of the rap, and putting aside the quality of the music, but just the idea of it's ugly, right? It's ugly, it's violent, it's mean, it's nasty. And that's part of become mainstream culture. That's a negative. So if we look across the, and then of course we don't want to talk about politics, but we know what the culture is like, both on the right and the left,
sure,
lying and deception and everything else. So changing the culture is changing all that. So it starts with changing the way people think. It starts with convincing them that there's such a thing as objectivity and reason is efficacious. And then the second element has to be the efficacy of the individual. You did build that, you know, to paraphrase Obama, to flip him upside down. You did build that. You do own yourself. You're a self-made man or self-made human being, right? So those are the kind of things that have to change. And I think if those change, then ultimately I think the music, the painting, the sculpture all change as well, because people don't want then a kind of an attitude that exists in a lot of the kind of the you know, rap culture, the gangster culture, whatever, of dismissing human life and belittling it and so on. Suddenly you value human life. You value business. Now, there are good elements in American culture still, and I think the strongest positive element in American culture today is our fascination and love of technology. You know, we adored Steve Jobs. We sit on the edge of our seats when Apple does an event and what's going to be the next great thing. And that's a good thing, and that's the kind of thing I'd like to see more of, and the kind of thing that we need to build on in a positive way.
Now, you mentioned this fascination with technology in the culture. Do you see any bright sides in the pop culture, whether it's the music or the film, even popular literature? Are there any bright spots that you find in the pop culture?
I mean, I certainly think there's good stuff out there. Is there a positive trend? I really don't see it. Now, television, I think, is very good from an aesthetic perspective. There's good writing, there's good acting, there's good production values. But there's very little romanticism. There's very little real recognition of heroism and free will and decision-making and moral challenges. But, you know, there are good shows. There are entertaining shows. I don't see much in terms of deep stuff, things that really make you think that are also interesting. You know, so you take a show like Breaking Bad, which was very well written.
Phenomenal.
Yeah, phenomenally well written, really well acted. But what was it about? It was, what, six seasons, five seasons?
Five and a half
seasons. Basically an idea and morality that you could have done in an hour and a half movie. That is, once you compromise, there is a slippery slope, right? So once you make that first little compromise, I'm just doing this because I've got cancer and I need to help my kids or whatever, and, you know, two episodes later, you're killing people. And then it just becomes how many people do you kill and how bad you feel about it and how to what extent does your family actually suffer and do you end up killing your brother-in-law and you know, and everything else, which just spirals out of control. But the principle of a slippery slope in morality, you can do that. And so I found Breaking Bad both entertaining and incredibly painful because it was obvious what was going to happen. It was obvious, you know, it's just the plot twists weren't obvious, but the essential characteristic, he had to die at the end. Everybody around him had to suffer. That was the logic set up in like the first three episodes, and you knew that's what was going to happen. So, okay, there's nothing more there, right? Even if you take the other characters, what was his name, Jesse? You know, in my view, Jesse should have died at the end because he deserved it. He'd killed people. He'd done stupid things. He was a complete second-hander. He did it all by following, not by leading. But he was morally responsible for his actions, and therefore he should have suffered the consequences. But there was no real character development. Yeah, he kind of regrets the stuff, but it wasn't. There's no romantic depth even in Breaking Bad, in spite of the good writing and the brilliant. I mean, the acting was brilliant. Production values. I mean, every episode starting with that teaser that sometimes you didn't even find out what it meant until like three episodes later. That was all really brilliant in the way it was done. But it really shows a culture that likes to we like to be in the mud. And get, you know, and revel in the mud and the best content out there. Anti-heroes, and where there are no heroes, right? Who is the hero in Breaking Bad? Nobody. I mean, the brother-in-law maybe, but an impotent hero the whole time. Yeah. He was right under his nose and he couldn't get it. So there are no heroes. Everybody's a bad guy, and those are the best shows. Now, that's not completely true. I mean, there's some shows. I really like Justified. I don't know if you ever saw Justified.
Only a little bit.
Yeah, and it had a hero. Even there, it had to make him a little dark and depressed and miserable. And, you know, that's the culture that needs to change. And you're not just going to change it by going to the top and writing better scripts, because nobody will produce them and then nobody will watch them. Mm-hmm. You have to change the way people in the culture think so that they demand a better product, and then hopefully some of them will become, you know, the writers and the producers of the future and make better product.
Now, I'm curious, and I know in Free Market Revolution, you and Don mentioned the rare instance of someone who's a hero, more or less, being a businessman in Tony Stark in Iron Man and all of that.
Yeah.
You say there are no heroes. What do you think about this current fascination with superheroes? Do you think that actually demeans the idea of a hero? Or what's your take on that?
And again, there are going to be people out there that are going to hate me after this. I mean, I think it's a sign of a culture in complete decay that the only heroes we can find have to have superpowers or, like Batman, incredibly dark and twisted, and the culture's falling apart, and Batman's basically, why is he even saving these people? I mean, I would walk away, let them all die, right? Because they don't deserve him. So it's really either darkness or superficiality in a sense of super. And then the moral dilemmas are not that interesting. Superman can't kill people. I mean, how stupid is that? It's just ridiculous. Why doesn't he just do it? I think he killed somebody in the last Superman or two Supermans ago, and there was a whole controversy.
Oh, yeah, and Man of Steel.
Yeah, Man of Steel, he killed somebody. Oh, my God, right? I mean, you're fighting an existential battle for the survival of the human race. You got to kill the bad guys. That's part of so, but it's the idea of super in order to create a hero. There are no real heroes. There are no heroes. So if we go back to Hitchcock, right? If you go back to the 50s in Hitchcock, it was usually his hero was an everyday man put in extraordinary circumstances who rises to the occasion and becomes heroic, right? So that's one type. And there were a lot of movies, if you go back into the 30s and the 40s and 50s, westerns, where either the person right from the beginning of the movie is a hero. Shane comes to name. I mean, Shane is a terrific movie. Even better books. I highly recommend reading. It's a little book called Shane, and it's a terrific book. And you like, you love the guy, and, and you know, I wish that was like an continued episodes on television, because it's so inspiring. Even though it kind of has kind of a sad ending, and it doesn't get resolved the way you ideally would want it to get resolved. But these are good people struggling with real issues. So the superheroes, I think are a sign of bankruptcy. People want it, right? Mm-hmm. They want the emotion that you get from watching somebody. But then it's all action. There's nothing conceptual about it, and it requires, even for the action, it requires an element of the supernatural in some sense. It's rare now when they have shows that have heroes. They tend to be more naturalistic. So I just watched 13 Hours, I talked about on a show a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in 13 Hours, it's about what really happened in Benghazi. And they're six guys. They're clearly heroes. But it's telling the story that what they actually did. And there's no real... I mean, there's some dramatization, but it's basically just factual. So why can't you create a story around that? Now, again, there are exceptions. There's better stuff that comes about. Mm-hmm. And that's good, but yeah, I swore, I think, what was it? I'm trying to think. Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was the last one. I think the one before last. The Captain America, I swore I would never go see another superhero movie again. I can't take it. It's so, I mean, plot-wise, they're so stupid, right? And I always, whenever I watch Captain America, I go, like, why isn't Iron Man here? Right? They're in the same universe. Where's Tony Stark? Why isn't he helping the guy? Now, at some point, they do. They all come together. They fall apart. But it's just the whole thing. It's unbelievable. And they try to deal with big issues like fascism and freedom of speech. But it all falls flat because it's basically all action. You know, I'd rather watch James Bond. James Bond is more real, even though, again, it's kind of... Even James Bond doesn't take itself that seriously anymore. I mean, Ayn Rand had a comment about James Bond, about the first one, I forget the name of it, the first James Bond ever made with Sean Connery, was really, she said, it was really fun and it was really good, and then they just went downhill because they stopped taking themselves seriously. It wasn't cool to take heroism seriously.
So do you think that you can change that just within pop culture, or does that have to come as a reflection of changes in the more basic culture? How do you do that?
It has to come as a reflection of the more basic culture. So you can't, that's what I said, you can't just make good movies because people won't necessarily respond to good movies. What you have to do is you have to go to the basics. So for example, I think that the whole idea of luck, the whole idea of you didn't build that, undercuts the demand for heroism because, you know, if we're all just automatons, we're all just machines, then heroism means nothing. It doesn't mean anything. You don't choose it anyway. Superman was just born with the genes to be super. That's it. And that's why, again, maybe the appeal of the superheroes. But if you can't make individual choices about your life, you're not then demanding people on screen make choices. So I think we have to change people's attitude, for example, towards free will and towards, what Ayn Rand called a self-made soul, the idea that you create your own soul, you create your own character, you are who you decide you are in many respects, if you take responsibility for that. And then I think people like that demand the romantic, the heroic, show me what a really good guy looks like. So in some ways, I can, in some aspect of my life, emulate that. So I think you need to change that. If people believe that the way to behave in reality is not based on reason, but let's say based on emotion or based on faith, then that is going to determine how they interact with other people, how they view businessmen, how they view technology, how they view science. It's going to, how they view politics. So I think it's these fundamental beliefs about the efficacy of reason, about free will, and about morality that then shape the culture. And if you think about America 100 years ago, there was a strong belief in science and technology, a strong belief in reason. Yeah, people were religious, but they weren't that. I claim that the evangelicals today are far more religious than at any period in American history. I mean, there were some awakenings where people got really crazy religious, but certainly more religious than the founding fathers and more religious than, let's say, at the turn of the century. And then So they really had this admiration for science, technology, industry, and reason. And then they believed that they were self-made men and women, right? They believed they could go and do anything. They could go to the West. They could build a farm. They could build industry. They could build a railroad. And in morality, they just wanted to be left alone. They wanted to live their lives. They were pursuing their happiness, which is what the Declaration promised them. So they didn't have a formal morality, but they had this sense of individualism. That's what we're trying to change back, if you will. In some regards, I think of what our mission is here. It's not so much to, I mean, Ayn Rand was a revolutionary philosopher, but it's not just, you know, get everybody reading Ayn Rand and get everybody to agree with Ayn Rand. It's more to take the Enlightenment and all the values and ideas that were at the foundation of the Founding Fathers and renew them. And Ayn Rand gives us the tool for renewal because I think she provides a philosophy that underpins the values that the Founding Fathers, the political values, but also I think implicitly the moral values that the Founding Fathers had. And now we've got a real philosophy. But, you know, Ankar Gatte, I think, he says once, you know, he says our mission is to save the Enlightenment. Mm. It's to return to those values, but better this time.
What do you think about the... A lot of people lately have been saying, you know, the basic values of the Founding Fathers were Christian ones. Yeah. We need to go back to this fundamentally Christian origin that we came from. What do you think about that? Is it completely separate from these Enlightenment values we're talking about? Have people just misunderstood? Is it a deliberate attempt to skew the Enlightenment? Because clearly the Enlightenment, while a lot of them were deists, they were not actually practicing religious people.
No, I think it's an attempt to, it's a conscious attempt to deceive the American people. And I think, because I think that the religionists want to own the founders and they want to own the Enlightenment because they value America. I always tell American Christians that, you know, they are an interesting form of Christianity. They're Americans first and Christians second. Mm-hmm. And that's why they tend to be pro-capitalism to some extent, right? Not really, but some extent. Because they're Americans. They love the founders because they're Americans. And then that doesn't fit with their Christianity. So they either, you know, twist their Christianity to fit Americanism or they twist the founders in order to fit their Christianity, and usually a little bit of both. But if you look back, if you read the founders, yeah, they were religious. Everybody was in those days. I mean, there was very you suffered a heavy penalty for not being somewhat religious, acknowledging the existence of a deity, and that's why they were called deists because they said, you know, we don't believe in all this other stuff, but we think there's a deity. But one has to wonder, did they even believe that? Or was that just the politically correct thing to do because otherwise they would have really been hurt? I mean, Thomas Jefferson was accused in the election when he ran for president of being an atheist. Now, what's interesting is that he won in spite of that accusation. If you accuse somebody, say, I mean, this was to the election right now. I mean, part of these emails that they found in the Democratic National Committee, one of the strategies to defeat Bernie was to call him an atheist. Sure. Now, this is on the left. They thought that would really harm Bernie Sanders. I mean, that's nuts. So if you look back, okay, so John Locke clearly was religious. And I think that undercuts primarily his epistemology and certainly his moral code because he's trying to stay within the confines of Christianity. But how religious was he? Remember, he had to run for his life to Amsterdam because he was afraid a Catholic king would kill him. When he returned, could he really express himself or was he afraid now of a Protestant king? And to what extent were all of these guys influenced by, let's say, Spinoza, who was very secular, he believed, I'm no expert, but to my understanding, he believed in a God that kind of set everything in motion and went away, like Aristotle's God. So, you know, to what extent they all read Spinoza. We know that. We know Locke read Spinoza. We know a lot of these guys read Spinoza. To what extent were they influenced by him? And certainly the founders were heavily influenced by the French Enlightenment. And one of the key characteristics of the French Enlightenment versus the Scottish Enlightenment is how secular French Enlightenment was. It was much more secular than Adam Smith and Hume and those guys. It was focused on a battle with religion. Voltaire had to escape, again, Paris to Amsterdam. Amsterdam was a cool place to live because you could do whatever you want or you'd say whatever you want. But because the church threatened him, all these guys, Diderot and Montesquieu, they weren't religious. They were secular. Many of them, like Voltaire, were atheists. So to what extent, you know, given that Montesquieu is the most cited thinker in the Federalist Papers,
mm-hmm.
to what extent were the founders influenced by the very secular French Enlightenment? I mean, there's no question they were. So if you read Jefferson's papers, if you read his letters with Adams, if you read them all, now sometimes he's indicating that maybe he believes something, and then other times he's indicating he probably doesn't believe anything. And I think he was struggling with it. But clearly, even Adams, who's considered one of the more religious of the founders, is not very religious, not by any standards of today. He was also closer to deism than he would be to evangelical Christianity or Catholicism today.
Do you think that there's reason to be optimistic when you look at the fact that the largest subsection of people in all of these religious surveys are the other category or the non-religious category? Is that a good sign or is that deceptive? What do you think of that?
I think it's a good sign. I think it's a very good sign. I think the fact that organized religion is in decline is a good thing. I think it means that people are more open to ideas. Now, granted, that the other category doesn't mean that they're pro-reason atheists. It just means that they've abandoned organized religion. But I think that's a step in the right direction. It makes them more like the deists of the past. The question is, what do they replace religion with? And that's the real challenge. So many on the left replace religion with skepticism. They replace religion with, the funniest one is when they replace religion with Deepak Chopra, right? So they replace one religion with another even nuttier religion. But it's a religion that uses quantum physics, supposedly, to justify itself. So anybody who's tempted by Deepak Chopra, you have to watch some of the debates he has with people like Sam Harris Dawkins, because they rip him to shreds. I'm inspired by the fact that there is a new atheist movement, and a new atheist movement that is really explicitly focused on reason being the alternative. There was a one woman show that played in LA and played, I think, later in New York, and you can get CDs and maybe even DVDs of this, called Letting Go of God. And unfortunately, I can't remember her name. But I think if you look on Amazon, Letting Go of God, you can find it. And it's a story, I think it's a true story that she tells. It's a one woman show. And she's very funny. She's one of the former writers for Saturday Night Live. And she talks about it, having this moment. I think some Mormons come to her door and she lets them in and has a discussion with them. And as they're walking out, she goes like, well, that's ridiculous. If you've ever heard the Mormon story, it's nuts, right? The Book of Mormon, the play on Broadway, reflects that pretty well. So she goes, that's nuts. And then she pauses and she thinks, wait a minute, is that more nuts than Catholicism, than a virgin birth and all the miracles and all the stuff, walking on water? And she says, that's not good because, I'm Catholic, So she goes on this discovery, right, of figuring this out. And she goes and she asks questions and she speaks to priests and she speaks to philosophers and she speaks to people. And over a few years, and her parents and, everybody. And slowly she's less and less religious. And then she abandons Catholicism. So she says, okay, so maybe it's Catholic doctrine that's no good. So she goes to other religions and she tries them out and they don't make any sense to her. And then she does the Deepak Chopra thing. She says, okay, well, I need to find something. So she does. And she's honest enough to say, that's complete crap. And in the end, what she embraces is, or at least, she says she embraces is reason. Reason is it. And it's a wonderful, journey. So anybody who's out there who was raised religious and has gone through that journey himself, I think would find this really both. She's really funny, too. So it's entertaining and stimulating.
What do you think, out of that other category, there seems to be a big split between the atheists versus the agnostics.
Yeah.
What do you think about that type of
dichotomy? I mean, I don't want to insult anybody, but my view is agnostics are just cowards, right? I mean, what does it mean? I can't decide. I don't know. But a lot of people are like that because they, it's the Pascal wager, the idea that there's a downside if we're wrong and God does exist. So people hedge for that. I think my parents are like that. I don't think they really believe, but as they get older, it's like comforting to believe. So why not? What's a downside, right? So they do because it makes them feel good. But I don't think deep down, I don't think in their prime, if you will, they really, they pretended to, but I don't think they really believed. And I think a lot of people are like that. So, but it's also an epistemological issue, right? people are uncomfortable making definitive statements. And you see this across the board. It's not just about religion. People are just uncomfortable saying, since there's no evidence for the existence of X, X does not exist. And, you know, all these people believe in God. There must be something there. Really smart people I know, like, you know, Newton and the Founding Fathers believed in God, so there must be something there. So I think they're tempted by these second-handed kind of ideas, that, and they don't have, because I think of the lack of science education and the lack of education in reason and how to think well, they don't have the epistemological confidence to say, no, you know, it just, God doesn't exist, there is no such thing, the burden of proof is on the other side, and there's no way they can prove this.
Very Fluian. So I guess, so we've talked about religion, right, and that's obviously a huge part of what makes up culture. When you talk about this goal of changing the culture over time, does that involve directly engaging religious people? How do you go about that?
Ultimately, absolutely, you have to. I mean, religion is a massively important part of people's lives, and it shapes their epistemology and their ethics and ultimately their politics. So, you know, so for example, if you're, the more devout you are, the more, in a sense, you've accepted a certain epistemological authoritarianism. You've accepted the idea that you're going to accept truth based on the fact that somebody said it, that it's written in a book. Okay, well, how far is that from accepting political authoritarianism? Without naming names, because we said we wouldn't. I think part of what's happening in the election right now is this, the epistemological authoritarianism of so many people in American culture that has not been challenged for so long is now morphing into a political authoritarianism and a willingness to accept political authoritarianism and a willingness to accept just not to think and just to follow. And so it's very scary. So yes, so it has to be engaged. The question is, how do you engage it? And I believe that you engage it at the epistemological and at the moral level. You don't necessarily engage it on the metaphysical level directly. So it's no, I don't think that the big argument, not that you don't get into arguments with individuals, but the big argument should be, is there a God or isn't there, right? And actually, the new atheists do a good job there, so I don't feel like we need to get engaged in that. What we need to get engaged in is the efficacy of reason, the objective nature of reality. You know, so it's the epistemological points that once you give up religion, what replaces them. It's the issue of free will that we've discussed. And then, of course, you've got this massive battle over altruism versus self-interest and what that means. And again, I was giving a talk the day before yesterday, I think it was. Tuesday was the day before yesterday. So the day before yesterday, we're taping this on a Thursday. I was in Minnesota, right? Wilmer, Minnesota, middle of nowhere. I don't think anybody in Wilmer would be offended by me saying it's the middle of nowhere because I think they know it. It's like 3 hours or 2.5 hours west of Minneapolis. You just drive due west, a little bit north. It's a beautiful country. It's you know, rolling hills and a lot of forest land, and it's really, really pretty, but in the middle of nowhere. And there were a number of young people at this talk that I gave at a company called Relco that invited me to come speak. And you know, you guys might be listening to this even, because I know some of you listen to the podcast, but one of them said, look, I really like a lot of what you say. I like the capitalism, I even like the reason parts, and I like the self-interest. The self-interest is kind of cool. But I'm a devout Christian. So how do I, you know, what do you suggest I do in order to meld the two, in order to get the two? And I basically said, you know, in a sense, that's your problem, not mine. I don't have any advice because I don't think it's doable. But I would rather you accept some of my philosophy than none of it at all. So if you want to hold on to rational egoism and your Christianity and find a way to make them work together, that's better than the alternative, which is no rational egoism, no. If you want to be an advocate for reason in 99% of your life and faith in 1% or whatever percentages you want to do, better than the alternative. That's more like America of 100 years ago, and I'll take that over America today any day. So I can't help you because the two are contradictory, but if I can just move you that's great, and that's what I hope to do. So I don't think our job at this point in the culture of war is to go after religion, qua religion, turning people into atheists. I think we have to go after religion qua faith versus reason, and religion qua altruism versus rational self-interest, and try to convince people about rational self-interest and reason and capitalism, and then things will take care of themselves. It might take a couple of generations. I mean, and you haven't asked this, but I think the battle is a very long battle. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is winnable short-term. I think this is a 100-year battle, or 100-year war. Battles don't last that long. This is a war. So, you got to make victories in the fundamental philosophical realm. You don't have to get everybody to accept the whole system. If they accept pieces of it and they pass pieces of it to the kids, then the kids are now more open to accepting more of it. And over a few generations, you can have a profound impact on the total culture. And then you can really challenge religion. I mean, I think Ayn Rand would be shocked that here we are in the 21st century and we're debating and discussing religion. I thought she thought that battle was over, let's say, in the 50s and 60s. Now, she did recognize that religion was back in a big way in the late 70s, and that's why she objected to Ronald Reagan, and she actually voted against Ronald Reagan I think she didn't vote that election, because she viewed Ronald Reagan as being religion smack into the heart of American politics, and of course, it's exactly what he did. Mm-hmm. But in the 50s, if you'd asked her, I think she would have been shocked. That's why there's no real discussion of religion in Atlas Shrugged. There's some mention in Galt's speech, but there's no real, there's no characters who are religious. There's nothing in Atlas Shrugged, because she didn't view it as the enemy. She thought, oh, yeah, well, religion, that's easy. That's not a serious threat. Kant, that's a real threat. You know, the philosophy, that's the real threat. So I think we have to take it on, but it's not that we have to attack religion. I mean, the times and places where you have to attack religion, but it's not like it's all or nothing. We have to be smart about it.
Makes sense. So you mentioned that this is a war, and a long war. So wars are won with individual battles. Where do you think, besides for the selfishness versus collectivism one that you already mentioned,
yeah,
where do you think the next battles are? Where does the attention need to really be?
Well, I don't know that you can boil it down to a few battles. I think there are a lot of battles going on simultaneously, because the culture is complex and it's a moving target and there's stuff going on all the time. You know, certainly right now, so there's battles, I think there are many battles in politics, and you have to be able to address a lot of them. There's certainly a more fundamental battle that the politics allows you to address, which is this issue of self-interest versus altruism. And then there's the more epistemological battle of reason versus emotion or versus faith. And in some sense, though, of course, they're all connected and they're all related, and you use the political battles in order to make points about morality and epistemology. So, you know, so obviously, a couple of years ago, Don Watkins and I decided that inequality was an important battle, because the left was making real inroads. They were changing the culture. They were making a statement. Everybody was talking about it. And we believed that inequality was a way that they were undermining what it meant to be American, the whole idea of American respect for success and admiration for wealth. That was being undercut through the discussion of inequality. And to a large extent, we wrote the book about inequality, Equal is Unfair, which you can get in Amazon, and you should all be reading. And if everybody who listened to the show bought the book, it would be selling a lot better than it is, although it's selling well. So the whole idea with there was to bring back the idea of where wealth comes from, that it is an achievement, that we should respect people like that. So a big part of the book is to emphasize the positive and then to show what the left is really trying to achieve through this inequality debate. So inequality certainly is an important battle. Another one, which we've identified recently at the Ayn Rand Institute, is free speech. If we don't have free speech, then reason is impotent, right? Free speech is a manifestation of reason. It's a manifestation of the fact that each individual has a reasoning capacity, should have the liberty to think what he wants to think, and as a reflection of being able to think it, say it. And even when we don't like what they say, even when we disagree, even when somebody says is blatantly untrue, right? He has a right to say it, as long as he's not committing fraud, as long as he's not inciting directly violence, you have a right to say anything you want. So free speech is a way of defending reason. By defending free speech, we're defending reason. And the attacks against free speech, you can see this, because the attacks against free speech are all based on emotion. Oh, you can't upset me. You know, you can't cause me a negative emotion. And really gives you an opportunity to discuss this emotion versus reason, you know, issue. So free speech is a huge issue right now. You know, since 9/11, foreign policy has always been a big issue for us. You know, you've done some research for Elon, and we've been working on foreign policy because we believe that foreign policy is a place in which we can make a really strong case for egoism versus altruism, for what does an egoistic foreign policy look like. And it's stuck because nobody else says what we say on foreign policy. So it's clear that we have a very different way of even approaching the issue. And then when you boil it down, what is that different way? It's the way egoistic versus the altruism. So those are the kind of battles we do. Now, you also have to have the battles at the universities on the philosophy. And you need Tara Smith having the battles on ethics or the battles on philosophy of law. You need Greg Salamieri and other philosophers in the universities engaging in battles on epistemology and on ethics and all, even on metaphysics. So the companion to Ayn Rand's thought is essential for thinkers to be able to see really how to understand Ayn Rand and what context and how to approach her and what did she really think about these important philosophical issues and how to view her as a philosopher. So there are many, many battles being fought all the way from battles at university campuses among professors on metaphysics all the way to political battles over free speech and foreign policy and the inequality debate.
You mentioned philosophy, and that's obviously a favorite topic of mine, and as I'd imagine that pretty much everyone at the Ayn Rand Institute. I was listening to an interview that Ayn Rand did recently, and she said that in her book there were 1.5 good philosophers throughout the entirety of history. So you've got Aristotle, and then you've got half of Aquinas minus all of the religion stuff. That's essentially her answer.
Yep.
Can you identify any other philosophers that you think have been important throughout history, philosophers that can be emphasized in the classroom apart from Ayn Rand?
Ayn Rand was not a philosopher, and she's not, in a sense, teaching philosophy. She's not in a classroom teaching. I mean, much of John Locke is – so the two questions here. Are there philosophers worth studying? There are many philosophers worth studying. The bad guys are worth studying too because you need to know what they say. But there are philosophers who say interesting things about interesting issues. And they're worth studying and they're worth reading and they're worth debating and they're worth thinking about. John Locke, obviously, he was foundational to the whole idea of individual rights. The whole idea of the Founding Fathers, the political system that we have today is very much based on John Locke's thinking. It's interesting to see how he came up with this, what his conception of rights is, what are the strengths, what are the weaknesses, why did he ultimately fail, why was he challenged ultimately by the post-Enlightenment thinkers, what was the issues, because that makes us better at defending our ideas of rights if we know how his were undercut. Why was his epistemology not so good? What are the issues there? Same with morality. Oh, now we see why morality is really, really important, because John Locke got it wrong. Spinoza, I think, is, you know, again, I should say the beginning. I'm not a philosopher, right? I'm an amateur, a real amateur. So this is all from the perspective of an amateur. You have to talk to Ankar, somebody like you, to really get the in-depth story. But my little understanding of Spinoza is there's some really interesting things there. Certainly with regard to metaphysics and his view of a deity and his rejection, ultimately, of an involved deity. But also in terms of morality. I think Leonard Peikoff says that he's one of the only philosophers who is tempted by egoism and is kind of trying to establish kind of an Aristotelian-like ethical system that is based on one's own flourishing. And I don't know how successful he was. He's really difficult to read, and
he's weird.
Yeah, he's strange, but he's also got a fascinating life. So he's just an interesting. And he died very young, and so who knows what would happen if he'd stayed alive. But he's very weird, and it comes from his studying kind of Jewish mysticism and rejecting that and being shunned by his community, and then getting involved in whatever philosophy there was at the time and the influences of. Other thinkers of the time. So he's very difficult to read, but my guess is there's some really interesting things there. And just in terms of the evolution of thought, he clearly injected some really good ideas about reason and about egoism into the debate that I think had profound impact on the Enlightenment and ultimately on the Founding Fathers and the establishment of the country. You know, if you go to the 19th century, again, I'm no expert, but my guess is that James Stuart Mill has some really interesting discussions about mm-hmm. issues. And while at the end I think his utilitarianism is a flop, he has some interesting things to say about liberty, about freedom, and interesting things to in an attempt to justify utilitarianism. And it's interesting just to figure out why it's wrong. It's not obvious. Just because Ayn Rand said it's wrong doesn't make it wrong. To make it wrong for you, you have to engage with these ideas, figure out why they're wrong, and actually get engaged. So there's too much in objectivism in among the followers of Ayn Rand. There's too much of she said X, therefore it's just true. It usually is with Ayn Rand because she was a genius, but it's not true for you until you know it's true, which means you have to engage with the ideas themselves. So you know, if you want to say definitively Mill is wrong, figure out what he said. So, but I think he makes some interesting arguments. There's some interesting things there. Somebody like Spencer is probably interesting. The real social Darwinist, right? Everybody mm-hmm. accuses Ayn Rand of being a social Darwinist. This is the real thing. It's interesting what he says and how he says it and how he justifies it. And again, there's some elements of good things and there's some really bad things. And of course, Ayn Rand read Nietzsche. And to some extent, certainly in her youth, was inspired by parts of Nietzsche. So if Ayn Rand read Nietzsche, you know, maybe, there's probably something there to be learned and something valuable to be there. So I think when we mere mortals make evaluations about philosophy, I think it's very different than Ayn Rand making evaluations about philosophy. Yes, given who she was, given her genius, given how she viewed philosophy, given the importance she placed on Aristotle, the half-philosopher is Aquinas in a sense that he resurrects Aristotle and engages with Aristotle. But the fact is that there are several other philosophers worth studying who make real contributions. We don't live today. You can't take modern life and all the achievements of modernity and say, oh, well, that's all direct from Aristotle. You know, they were translators and they were people who did real serious thinking and who made the modern world possible. And Locke, and I would even say you should read Adam Smith to understand kind of, he has some really interesting things to say about markets. Some of our presidential candidates should probably read some of it, particularly when it comes to foreign trade. But, you should read Adam Smith. Hume is a really interesting guy, yeah. Particularly when you get away from his epistemological skepticism. He has some interesting things to say about economics and about other issues. So there are thinkers along the way. Again, the modern world wasn't just created by a straight line from Aristotle and Aquinas in the middle. There are a lot of important. There's a whole tradition in the Netherlands of thinkers who talked about rights before Locke kind of set the foundations for Locke's discovery of rights, or the Lockean kind of approach to rights. So if you're curious intellectually, there's no shortage of material to read and engage with and really. I mean, one of my biggest frustrations in life is that there's so much I don't know and I'd love mm-hmm. to know, and just how do you prioritize how much, because there's tons. I'd love to know a lot more about history and a lot more about a lot of these philosophers and thinkers because it's all fascinating in my view.
That's really interesting to hear, because I remember at the Objectivist conference, I was talking to someone. They said, well, I study philosophy. And she responded with, oh, I love philosophy. I said, oh, well, who are some of the philosophers that you like? And she said, Ayn Rand. Yeah. And I thought, well, okay, but that doesn't actually, that's one single thinker, and there's more there. So that's really good to hear.
Yeah, no, that means she loves objectivism, right? And that's right. Great. But to love philosophy means to understand the key questions that philosophers have asked, why those questions are important, why they struggled so much to answer it, why it took 2,500 years from Aristotle to Ayn Rand, because the questions are hard, mm-hmm. you know, and what are the different sides, how have they answered the questions, what's interesting about some answers and maybe not so interesting about others, why are some viciously wrong and some just mildly wrong and some kind of right, and it's really to engage in the content, right? I'm not a philosopher, And I can't, you know, and I love some philosophy because some philosophy is way over my head and I just don't get it. But I find it interesting. And when I read the other side, it doesn't bore me. It doesn't anger me. It's kind of, why do they think this? Oh, you know, I see. These are the kind of reasons. This is what would lead him to think that. Well, that's interesting. And this is how you would challenge them. That's how. So that's what loving philosophy means, reading philosophy. And reading philosophy doesn't mean just reading Ayn Rand. And, of course, Ayn Rand didn't just read Ayn Rand. Mm-hmm. The way she developed her philosophy, she read a lot. And she read a lot of the people she didn't like to study, to understand, and to contradict. And she read histories of philosophy. And people like Leonard Peikoff studied philosophy, but they didn't just study. I mean, they spent a lot of time studying objectivism because it was brand new, and they had to spend a lot of time really digging and chewing and understanding it. But to a large extent, it's, you know, they had to know the world of philosophy in order to be able to think about some of the issues that objectivism raises.
So we've just started talking about Ayn Rand, and obviously that's a huge part of all of this. So moving a little bit in the direction of Ayn Rand in particular, we talked earlier about movies. Have you watched the Atlas Shrugged trilogy? Is that across your television screen?
Unfortunately, I've watched all three, and it was painful. And they're terrible.
I couldn't get to the third one. I tried.
Yeah,
I wouldn't.
I was in. I had to. I guess because it's a professional kind of responsibility, you have to do it. But the third one was the worst. Every one was worse than the previous one. And it's not like they spent less money. They spent more money in each one, I think. The first was the best, but still really bad. The second one was horrific, and the third one was just amateurish, ridiculous. It was just ridiculous, and people liked it. I don't get it.
Do you think there's value? I remember watching it and thinking, this could have been so good with a good cast, with proper funding. I mean, do you still think that's a valuable venture? I mean, especially if we're talking about changing the culture slowly, getting that movie in front of 300 million
Americans.
Yeah,
but you have to bring the talent together. It requires real talent. And it's not a question of money, I don't think, because they spend a lot of money for a movie, but it's a question of talent. You have to have really good script. You have to understand what's essential, what's not essential. You have to be willing to cut. It's a movie. It's not a book. You have to cut. You have to figure out what you have to keep and what you take out. And then you have to be very creative in how do you dramatize it and how you create interesting sets that capture people's attention. Again, a book is very different than a movie. A movie is visual. And what all these movies had were no visuals. The visuals were pathetic. They looked like a bunch of students got together and tried and filmed this.
Which isn't too far from the truth.
I don't know. I mean, they spent about $20 million on the third one, so you should be able to do better than they did. But so it has to be visually stunning, and then the acting has to be really good, and the acting wasn't in every movie. The acting deteriorated. So, it's a hard movie to make, really hard. So it's only worth making if you find the right combination of skill sets, if you find the right people to be able to make it. And they might be, the people might be out there, but to get them all in the same room, on the same page, working on the same project, I just don't see it. I just don't see it at this point.
I remember reading something that originally Angelina Jolie had said that she would be willing to be Dagny Taggart.
She was very excited about the project. She was actually involved in a number of scripts. And she not only was going to be Dagny, but she was going to be co-produce it.
Mm-hmm.
So she was excited about it. She helped find a director. They worked on a script together. And unfortunately, I can't remember right now. But I do remember reading one of the scripts that came out of this, and it was pretty bad. But then they picked a director, and then she and the director had a falling out. And so there's a lot that happened there. But she was, I'd say, for about 4 or 5 years, I think. She was engaged, and she wanted to do the project, and she was waiting, and she was frustrated that it wasn't getting done. Again, I think an Angelina Jolie Atlas Shrugged would have been much better than this one, even if it had been less consistent with the philosophy. This one, they tried to stick to the philosophy and lost the movie.
And even then, got it wrong.
What's that?
And even then,
they got their philosophy wrong because they condensed the wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
An Angelina Jolie movie might have really deviated from the philosophy, but at least people would have watched it, and people would have seen it, and it probably would have been a decent movie and good acting. She's a good actress. And you probably would have seen a spike in book sales. These movies did nothing for book sales. If anything, since the third one came out, book sales have declined.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
I don't know if there's a causal relationship there, but certainly the movies did not help book sales. Book sales peaked in 2009 before the movies were ever made.
So I'm trying to keep us off of the issues that everyone usually hears in this show, right? And so one of the questions...
Well, this is good, because I'm trying to get away from those issues on the show generally.
Right, no, it's got to drive you nuts.
I'm tired of politics, yeah.
One of the questions I often ask objectivists when it comes to the idea of another movie like that is, who would you cast as, say, Hank Reardon or John Galt? You know, who comes to mind?
I don't know. I'm not good at that game.
Yeah.
I know there is a game. I'm not good at it. Partially because I'm not good at remembering actors' names. You know, I like Mark Pellegrino.
I think
he would make a good one of those characters. I'd definitely include Mark. Partially because I think he'd be good for the project because he's smart and he knows the philosophy. So, I would definitely include Mark. But, you know, I don't know. There are a lot of good actors. I mean, there's no shortage of good actors and actresses. It's just a matter of finding somebody who's not cynical in the way they act, somebody who can play a hero straight. But I think they're out there. You know, I think they are out there.
Well, let's hope. It'd be a nice movie.
I mean, I recommended a few episodes ago this show, The Night Manager. And I think the star of that, and I forget his name right now, who might one day be James Bond, I think he's got the look of a hero. And I think he plays it straight. I don't think he's a cynical. He doesn't have that cynical, or the belittling of the heroic within himself that some actors do. So, you know, I don't know that Brad Pitt would have been a good because he has that. You know, even though he plays heroes, you never quite know if to take him seriously or not as a hero. So, and when he does play a hero, he's usually detached. But I'm no expert. That's the other thing, right? Who the hell am I to decide who's going to cast? So this is something I can say something generally about movies, which I think is important. People, and I do this too, right? People say, "Oh, that was a great movie." How do you know? By what standard is it great? What are the aesthetic standards by which we should measure whether a movie is great or not? Right? There's a lot of things. There's script. There's cinematography. There's acting. There's a dozen other things.
Right.
Music. Right? I'm not an expert in any one of those things. I'm certainly not an expert on all of them. Right. So I can say I really like that movie. That movie really impacted me. Or I've identified some good ideas in that movie. But for me to say that was a great movie, aesthetically, that was a really good movie, I mean, that's pretentious BS. And, I think objectivists and people generally... You know, this is a real skill. Art is a science, is something to study. It's something you have to go figure out. And what is great acting, right? Can you identify great acting? I don't know that I can. And, you know, who is a great actor? And some actors I watch and I go, wow, that guy can really affect me. I suspect that's great acting, but I can't point to what is it about it that makes it great acting. So I try, although I fail miserably, to not tell people that's a great movie. I say, I really like that movie. You might like it too, right? And these are the things I liked about it. I like the acting. I like this actor. I like the cinematography. But I can't say any one of those things are great because I don't have the knowledge of aesthetics to be able to evaluate that. And that's true of literature. Mm-hmm. So I'm very careful in books I recommend or in painting or in sculpture. And painting and sculpture, things I know a little bit more about. They're simpler, first of all. And I've studied them more in a sense of experienced them more and read about them. But even there, you know, what makes Michelangelo Michelangelo versus some other Renaissance sculptor? But there is something, because you look at Michelangelo and you go, whoa, this is different than that. But what is it? And to be able to articulate that, at that point you could say, I know, this is great. But 99% of the people out there who claim this is great, that's great, have no concept of the aesthetic criteria, never mind how to evaluate those things clearly in a particular movie or a particular thing.
Do you think that that's a symptom of just rampant epistemological subjectivism, just no standards for anything. If I feel it, it's true.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. It's unfortunately, it's as prevalent in objectivists as it is in the culture generally. It's this disregard for reason. It's disregard for experts. It's disregard for studying. You know, you want to really get to the point where you can really understand movies and really get the aesthetic. Study it. You know, and to study it means watching a lot of movies. It means reading about movies. It means understanding the art form that is a movie. It means all that. But study it. Use reason. Mm-hmm. And gain knowledge in order to become an expert in the field, just like you would never think of designing a bridge, but it's also true you would never think of saying, oh no, that bridge will stand 100 years, right? I'm a civil engineer, and I wouldn't say that without really looking at the plans, and even today I couldn't do that because I don't remember any of the stuff, right? But so you can't say this movie is immortal, will always live with us because it's a great movie. You have to have an objective basis to do that, and almost nobody does. And I think this is true of I see this all the time, again, among objectivists in particular, libertarians, mm-hmm. but the culture generally. Everybody's an expert on foreign policy. Like, I know about 100 people out there who know how to deal with Islam. They haven't read a book. They haven't studied it. They haven't spent the time. They've never met a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
But they know exactly what the problem is and how to solve it. Right? Really? You know, a lot of objectivists spout stuff on economics. And then you go, how do they know this? They read it in an Ayn Rand book? Have they studied economics? Have they taken an econ class? Do they know what economics, what it studies, how you study it, how to look at it? So, yeah, the basic is freedom is good. Fine. But what does that mean? What is supply and demand actually, you know, what is that? How does it function? How does it work? You know, so people today don't seem to take knowledge seriously. They seem to dabble in knowledge. And unfortunately, radio shows like this encourage that. Right, because I cover a million different topics, and am I an expert on all of them? Probably not. But you know what? I've studied a lot, and I've thought about most of these issues a lot, and I've read a lot. And you know, if you can match me with that, that's great. And I'll say, even what you hear from me, you should take with a grain of salt, because there's a lot of topics that I'm not. Now I know something in finance. I know something on the Middle East, and the problem of foreign policy. I know a bunch of other stuff, but there are a lot of things that I say that I'm not an expert in, and you have to evaluate that, you the listener, and some stuff you should be able to say, you know, Yaron, that needs more study before I'm willing to take your word for it, and I might be wrong on a lot of stuff that I say, so particularly on radio where it's extemporaneous, and you're just flowing, and you're just coming up with topics, it's really important to put that into context and remember, what do you really know? What is knowledge? Very few people think about what do I know versus what do I feel or what do I suspect or what do I have a probabilistic view of versus knowledge, you know, certainty. What am I certain of? And people, particularly objectivists, get this very confused. So I agree with you. I think it is an attitude of subjectivism and emotionalism and just a lack of epistemological rigor.
Now, for those listening at home, we promised we wouldn't mention his name, so I'll avoid doing that. But do you think that's this
he
whole
should
phenomenon?
Not be mentioned.
Yeah,
as a Harry Potter reference.
He shall not be named in honor of the new play that's been released. Do you think this whole phenomenon is how we end up with him? He knows virtually nothing about any of these issues.
Yes, I definitely think. I think he projects the exact kind of person that so many people in the culture have become. We're expert in everything. We haven't studied anything, but you know, our emotions are good enough. We're angry, and we will just emote. And I think he's reflecting back to people. You know, this was the Tea Party. We want smaller government. How do you get there? We don't know, but we want smaller government. We'll cut Medicare. You know, you can't cut Medicare, right? But we want smaller government. By the way, get smaller government without cutting Medicare. So it's exactly that kind of epistemological looseness. And I find people who tell me We like him. And I say, well, but do you agree with him on trade? And they go, no, trade, that's stupid. Of course he's wrong on trade. So why do you like him? And they can't articulate it, because what they like about him is this spouting off of certainty. Well, he doesn't really have it. And they're willing to tolerate all the nonsense because he's so assertive. And as I've said on the show before, this assertiveness is fake. It's a false. It's all emotional. There's no substance there. There's no there. And, you know, it's what we're seeing today on both sides in this election is a real reflection of the culture we have. Corruption, emotionalism, shallowness, lack of thinking, lack of expertise. You're seeing nobody has the mantle of reason. There's no talk of individualism. It's two collectivistic views of the world battling out. It's not America.
So that's our last comment about what's his name? He who shall not be named for this show.
So do you know anything about this play, this Harry Potter play? Is it supposed to be good?
Apparently it's really good. I know a couple people who have seen it, and it's the text is out too now,
okay.
So you can actually read it.
So where is it? Where is it actually being performed?
It's in London right now,
I think. So next time we're going to London, I'm going to try to go see it.
Well, there you go.
Because I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. I enjoyed Harry Potter, although it did in the end have some Christian elements to it. But anyway.
Oh, sure. I mean, what doesn't?
But it was fun. I loved Harry Potter.
No, that was one of the many pieces of fiction that when I was thinking about, you know, what would Yaron Brook like? I thought, I wonder if he reads Harry Potter.
So the story with Harry Potter is that my sons were about Harry Potter's age.
Mm-hmm.
So at your age, probably.
Yeah.
And so when the first books came out, they weren't quite reading. So I would read, the first one I would read to them. And then the second one, I think my eldest son could read then, and my youngest son couldn't. So I still read it to them. And then by the third or fourth one, they were out there standing in line at midnight to get them. And they cut me out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't reading it to them anymore. So then what we would do is we would get them on tape. They would read them immediately. And then we'd get them on tape. And we would do a road trip,
mm-hmm.
the three of us. And because my wife wasn't interested, so we'd do a road trip. And we'd put Harry Potter on. And we'd listen to it. I got to experience all of them, either by reading them to the kids or by listening to them on tape with the kids. And I found them, you know, heroic,
mm-hmm.
and moral dilemmas. And, you know, they're frustrating because anything with magic is frustrating. You know,
right.
Why didn't you just zap the guy and finish with it, right? The rules of magic are completely arbitrary, right, by the very nature of it being magic. There's no – she tries to codify some of it, but you can't really do it.
Yeah.
But given that, I was very entertained by it. I thought it was fun. I enjoyed it. Again, I'm not going to say it's great literature. It probably isn't, but it was enjoyable. And certainly for preteen to teenage audience, I think it's wonderful. And it does portray a hero who's really challenged, who's really in tough spots, both personally inside of his own head and existentially against the most evil creature in the universe. So
mm-hmm.
it has all the elements of good drama.
Makes me wonder, you know, we were talking earlier about this idea of returning to early American values. Have you seen much about the new film that's coming out, The Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them?
No, I have no idea what
it's,
that is.
It's set in America.
Yeah.
And so it'll be the same universe, you know, same rules or non-rules of magic, but they're putting it...
So this is a Harry Potter thing?
Yeah, it's J.K. Rowling's involved
oh,
with
it
and everything. It's set in America. Someone's going to get mad at me listening to this because I don't remember what century it's in.
That's fine, it doesn't matter. But I'll go and see it because, you know, J.K. Rowling has proven herself as somebody worthy of engaging with, so I'll go see it. You know, one wonders how much more she has in her in terms of the entertainment value of this universe she's created. But yeah, so, you know, and I watch a lot of movies. So I will probably go to see it. I'm trying to think what was the last movie I saw in the theaters. I went recently to see something. Oh, Star Trek.
Oh, the third one?
Yeah, I thought it was terrible.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you like the first two?
I really liked the first one. The first one was fun. But I think that the reason I liked the first one was because it had so many references to the old series.
Right.
And it had you could connect emotionally with it at the level of my memories of when I first watched the first series, which I really loved. I love the old Star, original Star Trek. And the second one I thought was okay. This one I thought was just uninteresting, boring. I didn't enjoy it. So
noted.
And then I'm thinking about going to see Jason Bourne because, again, Jason Bourne, I read the Robert Ludlum books when they first came out in the 80s. and it was exciting. I mean, these are the kind of books you can't put down. So you have to commit yourself to not sleeping that night as a teenager, as a young, I think I was in the young 20s, and I wouldn't sleep that night, and you finish the whole book, because they're so, he managed to do that, which is a way, and Ludlum, I thought, did that, at least for me. And so I enjoyed the books, and then I didn't engage with that character for 20, 30 years or something. And then the movies came out, and I enjoyed the first few. But now it's like the fifth.
Yeah.
And I'm like, do they have anything to say? Do they, you know, so the CIA, again, has another secret program that Jason Bourne is gonna wreck because it's illegal. I mean, doesn't the CIA learn? I mean, it's just too contrived at this point. So I might not see it. We'll see. Or I might wait to watch it on my iPad.
Well, they've been between two different leads now, too, right? Because they went back and forth between Matt Damon and then, what's his name?
No, I thought it was always Matt Damon.
Well, they started with Matt Damon, yeah. And then I think the fourth movie had...
Then I skipped it. Then I skipped
Jeremy Renner.
Oh, so I skipped the fourth one, because I like Matt Damon in the role. But, you know, I go to see a lot of the movies that come out. I saw the one about the Civil War recently, State of Jones. Was it called State of Jones?
Not familiar with it.
Yeah, so State of Jones. I would recommend it to a large extent because it was a piece of history I did not know. It happens during the... So I don't think it's a great movie aesthetically, and I don't think it quite... There's some dramatic elements that don't quite work because it's trying to tell a story that really happened, and things that really happen in reality don't have a perfect dramatic arc. That's just the reality, right? So you have to tell the story the way it happens, not what you would tell if you were making it up. And that's the beauty of makeup, is making something up of literature, because you can create your own original script. You can make a real dramatic arc. But I found it really interesting. It was a piece of history I didn't know, and it was about a hero, and he stood for real values and something really important. He was willing to fight and risk his life for them. So I enjoyed it. I wouldn't say it was a great movie, but I would definitely encourage people to watch it and see it. And it tells a story about, and I've talked about this on the show in the past, about the origins, the history of racism in this country, which I think is non-negligible. It's substantial. And I think to understand the state of the world today, to understand people's attitudes towards racism today, you have to understand what the history is. Generally, I don't think you can understand the present without knowing the past.
Sure.
So I'm a big believer in studying history and learning history and knowing history.
Race issues right now are pretty big. And actually, that might be a good place to go as we're nearing the finish line.
Yeah, we got about 8 minutes or something, 10 minutes.
So obviously, I mean, even just, you know, you trace back the last 2 months, and there's so much has happened in this country in terms of racial tensions of all sorts at various points. One thing I've noticed is that the ARI position, if there can be said to be a universal position, tends to be very different from sort of the national narrative. Do you want to talk a little bit about sort of how that is?
Sure. And I think those of you who listen regularly know that I've talked about this on the show several times. But I think it is. I think it's generally true if you look at our positions that they're almost always not left, not right, not easily pigeonholed. Opposition of foreign policy is not anybody's, right?
Right.
It's ours. It's very unique. And I think even opposition of free speech is unique. And opposition of racial issues, I think, is unique. I mean, I think we recognize the fact that racism exists in this country. It still exists in this country, and it has a history of existing, a history that doesn't get wiped out easily. It doesn't just disappear, particularly when the ideas that are at the core of racism are not wiped out. They are actually, in a sense, reinforced. So if you think about America 50, 60 years ago as being primarily an individualistic country, but there was this element of collectivism called racism, the worst kind of collectivism, the most barbaric of all collectivisms, that contradiction existed. Well, as a culture, we've become much more collectivist today and less racist. But in my view, that's just an opening for the racism to come back.
Which
because
is
we're collectivists.
Happening.
And I think that to some extent is happening. I also think that the civil rights movement left an opening for that racism to come back by insisting on affirmative action, which I think was a huge mistake because it institutionalized the reverse racism. Reverse racism is racism. Racism is treating people based on their race. That's what racism is. And it doesn't matter if you're treating people who are white based on their being white, or black based on their being black. It doesn't matter if you're privileging them or you're hurting them. It's still racism. So I think the fact that affirmative action is around, is with us, is institutionalized, the Supreme Court has recognized it, nobody is challenging it, is part of why we're seeing a return of kind of racism, both black versus white racism and white versus black racism.
Mm-hmm.
So the cop killings are certainly motivated by a racist agenda, and as is some of the, some, it appears, the evidence is mixed, but it appears that some of the shootings of that the cops are engaged in are motivated by individual cops being racist, but potentially whole police departments being motivated by race. So we don't have, I don't have, and I think most of the people at the Institute don't have this instinctual response, the police are always right.
Right.
That the conservatives do. The police engage in horrible, horrible acts against us as individuals every day, whether it's the prosecution of drug crimes, which are victimless crimes, or civil forfeiture laws, which allow them to stop your car and them, you know, and basically seize your car without you being found guilty of anything. They first seize your stuff. There's so many bad laws on the books today.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much non-objectivity in the books today that, yeah, for the most part, yeah, you know, I love the fact that we have police and they're protecting me, and I respect that. But I also am objective about it, and the fact is that they're engaged in many, many, many enforcement actions that are not just, that are not objective. And I have no doubt in my mind that when you take a person who goes and becomes a policeman for good, honest, honorable reasons, but he now has to chase drug addicts, or he has to chase drug traders,
mm-hmm.
again, in my view, a victimless crime, that corrupts him. It corrupts his soul. He's much more open to being bribed. He's much more open to just general corruption, particularly if you think about the violence that the drug trade encourages. I think it makes cops much more trigger happy and everything else. So I think the police is a corrupted institution,
mm-hmm.
and I think we have to recognize that. I don't view policemen as corrupt, but the institution has corruption in it. And you have to be able to tease out what is right and what is wrong, which shootings are justified, which are not, irrespective. And is there racism or isn't there racism? And I just think we need to apply the same epistemological standards that we expect everybody else to apply with regard to, let's say, antitrust laws or capitalism, which, you know, objectivists get real excited about, right, to policing.
Mm-hmm.
Was stopping this guy and pulling a gun on him justified because of a taillight? Should he have brought the gun out? Now, do we have all the evidence? Do we know what really happened? Have we watched the video? Was the video just a piece of it? This is just basic epistemology. Let's collect the evidence, figure out, and let's make a judgment. Let's not jump to judging and say, oh, the police always good. And let's not jump to judge and say the police always bad. Let's evaluate the case. So I think we have a much more nuanced position in mm-hmm. these cases because we want to treat this using reason, to do it epistemologically correct. But also, racism exists out there. I mean, I know this because, you know, Ankar Gatte has stories. Ankar Gatte is Indian, so he's very dark-skinned. So he's got stories when he traveled in the South of racism, explicit racism. I can tell you stories, and we don't have time for this, but I hitchhiked from California, from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., through New Orleans in 1979. I was 18 years old, and I hitchhiked, went out on I-10 and stuck my thumb out, and strange people picked me up. They're the only people who pick up hitchhikers. And now I'm you know, I look white and I look like any American, but, you know, people ask me where I'm from, and I'd say I'm from Israel, and you wouldn't believe the anti-Semitic comments that I got.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable. The people that picked me up, I got asked, seriously, this is not crazy, I got asked by somebody if Jews really had horns. I mean, this was 1979. We're not talking about the 18th century. I'm not that old, right? So these people like that exist. The whole thing about the Confederate flag. The Confederate flag is a symbol of slavery. And people defend it, and people fly it, and people are proud of it. Now, yes, not everybody flies a Confederate flag is racist, but they got to realize what it symbolizes. And the fact that they're still willing to embrace it suggests that, at the very least, they don't care about racism.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a much more complex issue than the right would have it. And, of course, it's not a knee-jerk issue like the left does, where the left says, oh, well, everybody's a racist and all cops are bad and so on. We have, you know, as I've said often, we're not left, we're not right, we're in a different dimension. And on this issue as well, as most other issues.
How much time do we have?
Whatever, about 10 minutes? Yeah, 10 minutes, okay.
I mean, I think that in itself is a really interesting issue. I mean, I even listening to one of the other episodes of your show the other day, someone assumed that you were Christian because you were running on a certain radio program in Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really do see things as left versus right, conservative versus liberal. Can you talk a little bit about why that's just completely insufficient?
Well, because I think there is no philosophy today. On that spectrum, there's very little difference philosophically between the sides. And if you think about it, it's a spectrum that goes from complete moral and epistemological subjectivism on, if you will, on the left, mm-hmm. to complete moral subjectivism on the right, because that's what religion is. I mean, my argument is that, Ankar is very good at making this argument, that religion ultimately is pure subjectivism, mm-hmm. because you know, you read it in a book. Somebody else got this revelation from God, and it just feels right to you, so you follow it. It's just emotionalism. It's just that's what faith is. It's not even intrinsicism, as Ayn Rand defines it, like seeing the thing in the thing. Since the thing isn't really in the thing, right, morality really isn't in the Bible, it's ultimately all subjectivism. It's ultimately you feel like this Bible is right. And of course, what does the Bible actually say, and how does anybody know how to interpret it?
Right.
And, you know, I studied the Bible with, you know, the Jewish tradition of the Bible, and every sentence in the Bible, we would study the 50 different rabbis who interpreted differently. And now, I don't know how many hundreds or millions of sentences there are in the Bible. You know, every one of them has 50 different interpretations. None of it means anything. So you, basically, you take what you want out of it, or you follow the rabbi you choose. So again, so you have this spectrum that isn't that meaningful. You've got statists on the left who want to control, you know, the radical left, they want to control everything from the bedroom to the boardroom to everything. But the more moderates want to control the boardroom. And then on the right, you've got, again, you've got people who want to control the bedroom, but they don't want to control the boardroom. But then, do they really want freedom in the boardroom as well? Not really. Most of them are for most of the regulations. So you've got statists on both sides. You've got subjectivists on both sides. You've got deniers of reason on both sides. I believe that the whole left-right spectrum is all one thing, and we on another. So, you know, so, but conventional morality is altruism, left and right. Conventional epistemology is skepticism, left and right. Conventional politics is some form of statism, left and right. We're for reason, unequivocally. We're for individualism and for rational egoism. Nobody even comes close on that one. And we're for laissez-faire capitalism. Medicare is not yours. Medicare is immoral. It has to go. It's economically and morally ridiculous. So it has to be abolished. Nobody believes in any of that. So we really are on a different dimension. And then libertarians mimic us in some respect, right? So they accept certain, they agree with us on certain of the economic issues. They don't care about the philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they do care, they tend to be on the left-right axis on philosophy. Or they undercut, you know, in my view, they undercut the whole argument. But even in politics, so many of them are anarchists. Where do anarchists fit in here? My view is anarchism is a form of statism, mm-hmm. ultimately. It's not a form of liberty. So objectivists are different, and part of our mission at the Institute is to articulate that difference, make it clear, and not allow us to be confused with the Tea Party or to be confused with the Republicans or to be confused with the left in any kind of way.
When I first started to tell people that I was going to be interning for the Ayn Rand Institute, as you can imagine, the reactions were very colorful. One of them was something to the effect of, was that just a bunch of people like Paul Ryan? And for some reason, a lot of people conflate objectivism with Paul Ryan, who is a Catholic who's very mainline Republican in many ways. How frustrating is it to constantly get confused with conservatives who in some ways use Ayn Rand?
Yeah, really, I mean, Ted Cruz is a great example. I mean, he was reading from Atlas Shrugged on the floor of the Senate, so he must be an objectivist, even though he starts every day on his knees. I promise you, you can't be a good objectivist and start your day on your knees. It's very frustrating on the one hand. On the other hand, it's great, right? Every time Paul Ryan says something positive about Atlas Shrugged, people go out and buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Every time Ted Cruz reads something, people go out and buy it. Hopefully, once they read the book, they realize that we're not Ted Cruz. But some people will never do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine, too. You know, again, I don't need, in the process of cultural change, it's not about going from zero to one. It's not about everybody becoming an objectivist tomorrow. It's a process. And if we can inculcate certain ideas but not others, that's fine, as long as we're doing some ideas. If people gain a respect for the individual by reading Atlas Shrugged but don't become atheists, that's okay. You know, Ted Cruz is probably better on issues like free speech and economics and a lot of other things because he read Ayn Rand than he would otherwise be. So, yeah, he's nutty when it comes to religion, but he's good on these other things. So there's a value there. So it's our job to say, wait a minute, we're not Ted Cruz, we're not. And this is why I encourage objectivists never to get excited about these candidates, never to all out support them, always emphasize the differences, always emphasize the things that are critical about them. But Paul Ryan has spoken very positively about Atlas Shrugged in the past, but he's also said, I'm a Thomist, I'm a Catholic, and I believe in altruism, and I don't believe in this Ayn Rand stuff. He's being very clear, but nobody cares. You see, the left is out to smear us, and they will use any technique they can to smear us, and one of the ways to smear us is to take the least popular Republicans and to associate us with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think long-term and with honest people, that doesn't work.
Are there any characters at all who you'd point to and say, you know, this public figure, maybe a politician, maybe someone who's just on, you know, the floor of some news network, someone who comes close to maybe not an objectivist, but someone who comes close to many of the values that objectivists usually hold?
I mean, sure, I think there are a lot of good, honest, courageous people out there doing good jobs. I mean, there's certainly, I don't know that there are many in politics. I can't think of anybody in politics, but I think that's because politics has been so corrupted and it's so, you have to pander, and because you have, when you have unlimited government, which is what we have today, you're really pandering to special interests, and that corrupts the soul. Even if you go into government with good intentions, it doesn't survive. So you saw how weak somebody like Rand Paul was, even though a lot of his ideas are good, but he's weak. He's not, you know, because I think he can't, you know, he once said something about affirmative action about the that people should be allowed to discriminate, and the part of the civil rights bill that didn't allow people to discriminate on private property was wrong, and he got crucified for that. So he's careful, but that caution is what makes them weak. So listen, but suddenly, you know, you got to admire somebody like John Stossel, who in spite of the leftist, you know, push or the conservative push in Fox, does these shows that are very pro-free market in kind of an objective way. He doesn't always get it right. I don't always agree with him. I think he's too influenced by the libertarians when it comes to certain issues like foreign policy. But the guy's good, and he's courageous, and he's brave, and he's just a good guy. And he's smart, right? And there are people like that. You gotta admire somebody like Rick Santelli, who stands up at CNBC in the middle of the financial crisis and before... While everybody's blaming government, he says this is, or everybody's blaming the markets, he's saying this is government's fault. You should all be reading Atlas Shrugged. Let's start a Tea Party revolution, right? And he does start a Tea Party revolution. You know, it wasn't a revolution in there, but at least it got started. And the people at CNBC hated, you know, really went after him because and at the time it was owned by Disney. Maybe it still is. And Disney's quite left, and they went after him. So there are a lot of people in the media, there are a lot of people out there who are public figures who are very, you know, to take a different spin on this, somebody like Dave Rubin, who does the Dave Rubin Report on YouTube, and he's got his own kind of presence. He's center-left, I'd say. You know, it's hard to tell yet. He might be evolving into kind of a libertarian. But he's courageous, so he's got the wrong view, in my view, on climate change. But he just interviewed recently Alex Epstein,
right?
And he also interviewed the hockey stick guy, man, who's you know, from what I've read, really corrupt. But he interviewed him, and he had a real exchange. Now, I don't know if Alex convinced him or not, but he's willing to have that debate, and he stands up for free speech. And so I think people like that are incredibly courageous. See, you don't have to be an objectivist to get my respect and to be worthy of respect. To me, it's about standing up for values and sticking with them and using reason as your guide, reason as your standard. And I think Dave tries to do that, and I think somebody like John Stossel tries to do that. They are on the premise of facts, on the premise of reason, on the premise of let's explore, let's identify, let's figure out the what's true and what's not. And that's what you really want. And I think that figures like that, once in a while, I'll read something in the Wall Street Journal, and it's just terrific. Mm-hmm. I just read, I think I did a show recently about, I read stuff in the, people get pissed off when I say this, but I read stuff in the Atlantic Magazine, which is a left-of-center magazine. But once in a while, somebody writes some of the best stuff on free speech were published in the Atlantic Magazine. I did the show a few weeks ago about American Indians and the reservations, and the whole article is about property rights, and wow, that's cool. So there are good people out there that do good stuff, and you got to find it where it is, and you got to respect it, and you got to support the good and condemn the bad. And the good doesn't mean some kind of platonic good, some kind of ideal of the good where somebody's perfect and everything they say is completely 100% aligned with me. I mean, that would scare me if there was somebody really like that out there. I would wonder whether they were really first-handed and whether they really, we're going to disagree on some concretes. We have to.
Right.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense. I think we're right about at the end.
I think we are.
Just to cap it off.
Yeah.
We started by talking about how to change the culture.
Yep.
You didn't get the chance to stand at the podium in that one episode and do it. 1 minute pitch. Someone listening at home, they want to change the culture. One person, what do they do?
Well, I think you have to become a real advocate for reason and rational self-interest. Those are the two fundamental ideas you have to promote. And you can promote it through advocacy of capitalism. But if you think about it, those are the three pillars. Reason, individual, rational egoism, and capitalism. And if you can find different ways to engage in all three and to push them, you change the culture one mind at a time. And, of course, the best proponent of those three was Ayn Rand. So the easiest way to do it is to get people to read Ayn Rand. And she wrote novels, so that's the beauty of it. There's the great romantic art. Get them to read The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. That's what changes lives. Once in a while, I'll change somebody's mind in an audience, but usually it takes them reading The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged to do it. So get the word out there. Get Ayn Rand's ideas out there. Get the Ayn Rand Institute's podcast, blog, website, content, Twitter. Twitter's hard to change anybody's mind on Twitter, but YouTube and everything else. Get the word out there and engage with people, but engage on substance. Use reason. Always use reason. Try to avoid emotional arguments. They don't help. They don't help the cause. Advocate for real rational egoism, which means you have to understand what real rational egoism is, and then advocate for capitalism. And I did a talk this last summer conference on what one can do, and it'll come out on YouTube soon, I'm sure. And I think you'll really gain a lot from it in the sense of how do we change the culture? What can you do to change the culture?
Well, there we have it.
Great. Thanks, Chris. You made this show much easier for me than usual.
And cool. People got to learn about some films.
Yep. You've been listening to the Ron Brooks Show, and I'll talk to you all next week.